Welcome to this episode of Keep the Hotel Empty. I'm your host, Eric Paul. In studio today, we are grateful to welcome in author, event planner, and beaming optimist, Leah DeCesare. In this episode, Leah discusses with us the challenges of being an author, some of her creative writing process, and what she does to ensure not only her success, but the successes of those around her. Please enjoy. Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty to welcome in writer, event planner, and empowering optimist, Leah DeCesare. Leah, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming down. So I know you've got quite a pantheon behind you, from writing books to planning events, of course, to helping bring medical care to Uganda. Mm-hmm. So let's start at the start, because that's quite a swath. Can you tell me where you're at in life, where this mentality of the importance of connecting people and helping people starts to kind of reveal itself to you?
I think that it's one of the cool threads that I see in my very divergent and weird career path,
whole
thing. I think connection is really part of it, and sometimes it's through mentorship. The earliest memory I have of being a mentor to someone was in fifth grade when I worked. I was picked to be a Special Olympics buddy in fifth grade, so as far back as then. But I think even in high school, I was in clubs and things like that, that really, I just loved being with people, connecting with people all the way through. So,
did someone exemplify that to you, or was it just like one of these moments hit you, gave you the warm fuzzies, and that's the way we went?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's one of those things that it's just part of who I am, that I kind of don't, I can't put a finger or point an arrow to where it started. I think that I'm very lucky to have had a really great upbringing with really strong connections built in. I have a strong family that we always joke, is Thanksgiving's coming up, that we're like grateful to be together. We really like to be together.
Nice.
So I think, you know, I had a great relationship with my grandparents and my parents. And so I think that just connection has been a through line and just felt natural and comfortable. And as someone who is more extroverted, I love being alone. I mean, writing is isolating and solitary.
Sure.
But I think that, like, I love being with people. I love learning about people. I love figuring out, you know, where we're the same, where we're different, what can you teach me that's new, all that kind of thing. So I think just connection is a theme of my life.
Do you have a big family? You're not from Florida, right?
Yeah, no, I'm not from Florida. We're just past a year mark here. And no, not a really big family. So I am one of three, the oldest of three. But my dad had two sisters, and my mom was an only child. My husband's an only child.
Oh.
So it's kept the family fairly small. I mean, the core of us, we were all together this weekend celebrating my mom's 80th birthday. And I think we were 13 people. So it's a smaller family, but...
So some of that desire to connect may have been born of being tighter like that?
Yeah, very possibly. Yeah, very possibly.
So where did that start taking you? When you're in high school, how do you decide you're going to, what's step two? You're feeling good about connecting, you're feeling good about empowering people. What are you thinking that's going to lead you to next step?
Yeah, I really think that there was not much thought behind it. It's just sort of where I go. Right. I think that, like, from the earliest time I can remember, I wanted to be a writer. And interestingly, though, it's not what I chose to study in school.
Hmm.
So I wrote through high school. I wrote through, you know, from the earliest memories. Side note, I'd recently, you know, found a bunch of my mom dropped off a bunch of artwork for me, all the old stuff, and said, you know, hey, here's your old scraps. And in it, I found a treasure. It was something that I had drawn from when I was probably, we figured out, 5, 6, 7-ish. And the top was a pre-printed heading that said, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And it's me at a desk with a disproportionately large pencil, a very neat desk, I might say, which, you know, I'm not always known to be a super neat desk. But it had a stack of books, which, like, my life is books, and it had a plant on the desk, which is very me. So from the earliest time I can remember, I wanted to write. So that kind of led me through and guided a lot of my choices and decisions, although interestingly, veered off that path for college. I thought it was probably not practical, and so I ended up studying advertising and marketing to to be, I thought, I'll write copy. But meanwhile, all I really ever wanted to write is novels. So I don't know where my brain went for that. I don't remember anybody pressuring me or anybody saying, oh, you should be practical. No, I think I did it to myself. And all through that, I think I just always, I was a joiner, and I was often a joiner who ended up being the leader in an organization. So, again, that was part of my connecting piece. I remember, gosh, this is funny. I hadn't thought about this in a while. When I was the president of the high school leadership council, I was so sappy. But we were effective. It was good. But I used to do this group hug as part of the thing in high school. I think that's always just been yeah.
Was that when you started to be the joiner that ended up being the leader?
Probably, yeah. I mean, a lot in high school is where I remember that, and then in college, and then throughout my life. In fact, when we moved to Rhode Island in, it was 2006, I think, and we were laughing because I had been in so many volunteer roles that really the only way to get out of them was to move. It wasn't why we moved. However, once we got there, I was like, oh, this is kind of nice to not have these responsibilities. I had little kids by then. And it was 3 months in, I think, and I came home from an event. I was like, well, so I think I said yes to something tonight. My husband's like, oh, well, it took you all of 3 months to be back into a leadership role. So I don't get out for long.
Yeah, that's just part of your fiber.
I try. I get overwhelmed. I'm doing too much. And I'm like, okay, I'll phase out of that. And I'm with nothing for a little while and then right back into something else. So
when you've got this passion to write and you clearly want to write novels, yet you end up going to college thinking that you're going to get a marketing angle and maybe write some copy, was that like a financial fear thing, or was it strictly just a practicality thing? Because you do come back to writing your novels, right?
Yeah. So I think I was just being practical. I mean, I don't know what it's hard to remember back that far, but I don't know that it was anything more than, oh, I think that this would be practical, which probably practical does mean money, right? Can I make a living at it?
Right.
So I'm sure that had something to play into that. But I ended up not really going into that business anyway. I fell into I had an internship one summer at Revlon. And I loved it. And it was in product development, but not product development from the scientific end of it. It was the marketing end of it, where you were doing focus groups. And we would get, I remember getting samples, and we would be the testers, and we would fill out forms and take them home. And one night, we had a sample, this like face peel, and I was burning my eyes and my nose, and I couldn't wait to get this thing off faster than ever. But I loved that kind of world. I mean, I knew the woman who was naming the colors of the nail polishes.
Oh, how fun.
I was like, I want that job. I loved this world. But so I got advice at the time, you know, I was about to graduate college, and they said, what you should do is go through a retailer training program first, like be on the buying end, the retail end first, and then pursue and switch into a like the vendor side of things. So that's what I did. I ended up working at Lord & Taylor and loved it, but I was in buying for a while. And it kind of wasn't me. I loved the parts that, again, connection. I loved the parts where I was interacting. So we were going to market. We were interacting with the vendors. And then I liked the merchandising part because that's creative and I have an eye for that. But most of the business was really glorified accounting. It was the same exact thing month after month, figuring out you're open to buy, figuring out what needs to be marked down. It was the same thing. It was just like pretty accounting. And I didn't love that, and eventually switched into the public relations department at Lord & Taylor, which was in their fashion department. So I had a ball. Yeah, I did fashion shows, new store openings, special events of all kinds, from celebrity appearances to designers to all that. But it was a blast. But that's how I fell into event planning.
Because I was going to say, so this is kind of the crossroads of being able to be creative but still have some analytical function of the organization portion of the show.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Okay, so after you get into the retail world, and that seems to be, you know, kind of quite, we're almost at the mark, how do you start to transition out of that? Because you were there for a little bit. You did that for a little while.
Yeah. One word, babies. So
yeah,
babies
that'll change things
in a big
things.
Way. So, I mean, this was in, okay, so it was 1998, and I was working in New York City and living in Connecticut. And my daughter, you know, there was no work from home. There was
internet, really.
I mean, yes, there was internet, but nobody was really using it.
No.
And I was, you know, an hour away by train. If you miss the noon train and you have to wait till one, but the babysitter's calling, I just didn't. And I always did think I always knew I wanted to be home with kids. I knew I wanted to be a mom. And I was really grateful to be able to do that. So that's the part A of babies, was having one. But then part B was becoming a doula. So being in this group right after my first newborn I was like a new mom's group. Mm-hmm. And it was the best thing ever. It normalized the entire experience. It anchored my week. I had something to get us up and dressed and out the door for.
Right.
And then those women are still my friends. So that's 25 years ago, and we are still getting together and hanging out and laughing like
crazy.
Cool. So it's awesome. But that specific experience made me become a doula, because the nurse who ran this postpartum group I loved the group, and I was like, I don't want anything to do with being a nurse, but I want to like give this experience to other moms and help normalize it and help feel and be connected and have that support. So I after my son was born, I ended up going and getting trained and getting certification after certification in all things birth and babies, from, you know, prenatal all the way through to postpartum, postpartum education, postpartum doula work, birth doula work, lactation consultancy work. So anything to do with babies, I went and got certified and was deeply immersed in that for at least a decade.
And the backbone of this kind of is being able to empower people as well.
Yeah.
So how does that become such a profound thing? Does somebody really, did it happen more in the case where somebody empowered you and your gratitude for that led you to want to do that? Or you empowered someone and it felt so good that you were like, hey, I'm going to keep doing this?
Yeah, I think in that specifically, it was Lynn, this wonderful nurse. Like, I loved this nurse. And she just made us all feel like we could do this thing that was so slippery and confusing, and something that worked on Monday didn't work the next day, and you didn't know what you're doing right or wrong, or everybody's feeling these kind of things. So,
right.
And it made me connect with other moms through that. So I wanted to be Lynn for other people, I think is how it started. So I really started in a postpartum role and then backed into doing births with people. And I love that you use the word empowerment, because I think that that's the other through line in my life. And a lot of it is very much through things like through mentoring, through even I can see an angle in that with event planning, right? Like, I'm the host of an event. I've worked with brides and for conferences with clients and stuff. And I think that being able to empower someone in whatever position they're in, or if it's a professional role, if it's a personal role, if it's, you know, I don't know. I do love that.
What do you think is the big payoff for people when you do that for them? Is it showing them confidence that they didn't necessarily know they had, or is it just the sharing of information and you do with it what you will? Or what do you think's the magic sauce in that on the other end?
Yeah, I mean, I would hope that it can help someone else to believe in themselves. Like, I think that was one of the greatest gifts that my parents gave me. And being able to believe in yourself is kind of like the secret to everything. It allows you to then, and to love yourself. I think that's part of it, right? Loving yourself, self-love, self-belief, lets you step out and try something new. It opens that comfort zone from here to here to here to here to here, right?
Like, exactly.
It lets you go out and grow your world. It lets me be confident to say hello to somebody new and to start that relationship, to say, hey, I have this idea for a nonprofit. Okay, let's do that. I'll ease into the story maybe of the medical center. You know, that idea of just being able to say, okay, well, we can do that. Let's just do that. Confidence is the base of all of that. And so I feel like when I am working or as a volunteer, mentoring people from new moms to, I have a little sister from Big Brothers Big Sisters.
Cool.
She just turned 29. We matched when she was 7.
Dang.
So I just think, like, if I can help other people, even my novel, the thread of it and the message is believe in yourself. And I think if people can really believe in themselves, then it makes them be able to make their own lives better and pursue the things that are going to make their own lives better, things that they want to enrich themselves with.
Yeah, that's very cool. And I definitely want to talk about the medical center, and I'd like to hear about some of these other commitments, but I kind of want to dig on this one for a second.
Sure.
Where do you see the root of this coming from? Because I know for me personally, my confidence in those things come from keeping the commitments to myself. My self-discipline mm-hmm. is the drive for that. But not everybody's so great at self-discipline. How do you help people develop those feelings of empowerment, feelings of confidence, feelings of like, yeah, I can do this, without having to be so rigid or so rudimented in no slack, no rest for the weary, yeah. get it, you know?
Yeah. Well, I imagine like everybody's different, and I think everybody probably comes at it in their own way. Like, you know, you're confident and you find it in that space, and then maybe somebody else is super confident, but they find it in a space that's the complete opposite of maybe you right. or I, who are more organized or more, you know, regimented or more disciplined in something. So I think it's a matter of, and I think a lot of that comes from when I was a doula as well. Mm-hmm. I consider myself a fairly non-judgmental person, and then as a doula, that is very much part of the job,
sure.
is to be able to support a family the way they want to parent. And so I'm here to be like, okay, there's very few real rules that are yes or no, and it's about safety or something. Mm. Otherwise, I'm like, all right, I'm here with you. If you want to have the baby sleep in your bed with you, I will show you and teach you and help you to do that safely. The second you tell me, hey, this isn't working anymore, I'll give you ideas. You test them, you try them. Maybe they'll work for you, maybe they won't. But you can try that all out. I would go from like the family who like recycled every single solitary thing, like a blown tissue was recycled, right? And then the next hour, the afternoon or the next day, I could be in a home with a family who had like, you know, stacks of water bottles, each one thrown in the garbage, yeah. right? Like, I mean, all extremes. And we used to say like, there's 100 ways to cook a ham. And it's true. Like there's 100 ways to, a million ways to raise a family to, right. to do you. And so I feel like it's not really my position or intent to ever have somebody do it my way, but mm-hmm. really to let them find it in their own way and to find that kernel of love for themselves, that kernel of belief in themselves, and then to be that support if that's the role, for example, as a mentor, right? As a doula, even to have the mm-hmm. role of helping to teach if they need that, helping to guide them, but also to be that sounding board or the you can do this person, right?
Right,
you've
right.
got this, you can do this, and I'm here to help you, support you along the way, but you're going to do it your way. You know, you're the driver. I can help navigate. I can help, you know, give you tips or ideas. That's also part of being that professional or a mentor. Hey, I've walked this path. I can give you some ideas, or we can find them together. If
the Sherpa part.
Yeah.
When you're part Sherpa.
Yeah.
How important or how often do you find that you're able to employ the philosophy that there is no wrong answer? These are not yes or no questions, because I know a lot of people will mire themselves in things where it seems like there are yes or no answers. It seems like there's a right or wrong way to do things. So how is it that you can develop that mentality in people, and how important do you see that being?
Gosh, I don't know how I develop it or if I do, but I would say like as a parent is the first thing that comes to my mind. I mean, we're constantly having to, you know, let the kids know that it's their way and that we're here to help you, and we're not going to tell them how to get there necessarily. Like we can give you our way that we got here or what our examples are, our life experience, but I don't.
Is that sort of trying to impart that it doesn't matter how if you know why?
Yeah, philosophy? I love that, because I think that values are really important. Mm-hmm. And if you can really know your values, then you can return to those for decisions and throughout your life. And that's going to help guide you by defining those values. So, yeah, I think knowing in yourself and maybe helping to clear the way to find that. And certainly the idea that, you know, this idea that perfectionism is so pervasive in our culture.
Sure.
And so very much what our kids are seeing regularly, right? Like out there on social media, all of us,
right?
Adults too, right?
Yeah.
Everything they think that, oh, they got there. Our son just said something to us recently. It's like, well, gosh, like, you know, you guys always know what you're doing. We're like, wait, what? We can't give that impression?
No, just a good actor.
No. He's like, I call you before I call Google. And we're like, well, thank you, but we're often Googling to help you. So I think that there is a really, there is a very big role in knowing that there is not one right way.
Right.
There is not one right answer. And I think that's at the heart of a lot of discord in our whole culture right now, is that we think one way or another is the right way, and nothing is that black and white. There is a whole heck of a lot of gray all the way in between, and yellow and orange and purple and green and all shades of those colors, right? Like
Amen.
There isn't. I mean, we're all as unique as you know, every single person, I mean, as close as I am to my husband and my best friend, we don't see the same on everything.
Right.
But we also save that space for each other to disagree, to hear different points of view, to understand one another. And I think
Absolutely.
We all walk a different life. Even if we're walking side by side the entire way, they're different lives, you know? So I think that being there to reflect on that and help people see that in their own space and be able to follow their own true path. And I guess that goes back to believing in yourself to follow your path and not someone else's path.
Right. And this is where this this commercialization of perfectionism, I think, has kind of come in. And I know it does make it hard for people to see things as that gray area because it does seem like there's a right and wrong. Mr. Perfect did right. this, I'll do that. Right. Ms. Perfect did this, I'll dress like that. Are there some other things that you see the perfectionism and the, for want of a better term, the current culture that's doing to people that's kind of eroding our connectedness?
Oh my gosh. Well, yeah, I think that so much of it, that is at the root of it, is that we're not being ourselves. I mean, there is this lack of authenticity. I think there's a fear sometimes even to be authentic.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm where
right?
I'm going. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, and there's is it current? Has it always been? Is it more now? Does it go in waves? I don't know. But this idea of, like, you know, being canceled for the current term, like, there is a fear of saying, like, I can be truly who I am because I'm going to be called out, whether it's, you know, publicly. It could be within a group, whether it's a social group, a college group of friends, a colleague group. Can I say this, or is this going to be perceived this way?
Right.
If I type this one little thing and mean it this way, is it going to be taken this way? I mean, I think there is that, and anytime we're kind of having to pull ourselves back from being that authentic person and be ourselves, I think that avoids connection. I mean, it's a detriment to connection. You know, we have to be able to have some degree of vulnerability to truly connect with somebody else. And we have to be able to, and vulnerability, like, I'm not talking about what we might think that vulnerable feels like, right? Like,
yeah.
There's always space for boundaries. But I think that we do have to be able to open ourselves up and be truthful and honest as we know it, and to be able to share enough of ourselves to be able to truly make a connection.
Right.
It's not just a how are you doing, it's something deeper than that.
Do you think that the way it's kind of been couched now, that if we disagree, we can't even conversate?
Yeah, it bothers me a lot. It's something that exact thing bothers me a lot. It was football Sunday, and there was a commercial on. And there's two buddies, and they're in the garage watching a football game. And one of the guys goes into the fridge to get a beer and pulls out some fancy dog food. And then he's kind of criticizing his buddy about the dog food. The next scene, the buddy is outside the garage door, and they're closing the garage door on him. And I was like, this is so accepted in our culture now that if you disagree, you can't be friends. I've had people say, oh, gosh, well, I you know, so-and-so disagrees with me. I've had to cut people out of my family life. I've read this in memoirs, in books. People have said it to me. And I was like, I just can't accept that. I don't like – I mean, sure, there's time and place for cutting people out of your lives,
yeah, right.
I guess.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
I have had to. But I guess if there's people who are not good for you, who are not making you be your best self, okay, that's fine. We have limited time. You put your effort into the relationships that matter to you and that, you know, lift you up and make you your best person. But I really – almost resent the fact that if we disagree, we can't be friends. Or if we disagree, I'm going to cut you out of my life. It doesn't sit with me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's always been a time where people have had, you know, estranged family members or friends or whatever. But now this whole, I have a toxic person I cut out almost got to be like a badge of honor. I did that one. I cut someone out, you know.
And it's accepted. It's not even like a raised eyebrow. Like, well, of course, that makes sense. Of course you would do that. And I don't know. I just, you know, somebody hurts you personally or that. But if you just disagree, if you're having, I don't know.
What do you think the biggest things are that we're losing in light of this becoming more just the case?
Well, I think that any time we're getting in the way of real connection and real relationships, it's that, you know, there's an opportunity lost. Like, it's an opportunity to get to know someone else, an opportunity to cross over and have true understanding, opportunity to meet someone and know their history and their background. And by the way, I really believe that most of us, probably come down way closer to, we're more similar than we are dissimilar.
Oh, for sure.
And I think that that's lost right now, completely lost.
Agreed.
And I think that, especially in the extremes, but I think that even without the extremes, now in like all the center as well,
right.
We're so kind of divided that way. And I think that if we were able to sit across the table and say, you know, let's take a controversial issue, let's talk about that. And you talk about it from your point of view, and I can say, wow, huh, I never really thought of it that way. I still don't agree with you, but I understand. I can understand where you're coming from. I can have compassion about that. I can have empathy about that. Now we have a connection. Whereas I think that we're just closing the door on all of that immediately and not even allowing that bridge to be drawn, not even trying to get to one another or understand one another. I mean, it's hard when you move to a state and it's automatically a political statement. I moved to the state because my father died and my mom is down here and I'm hate the cold.
Right.
So who cares what I believe politically? Like, why does that have to be that you think that because I changed my address, you now know everything about me?
Right.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting.
About, but that happens. Yeah. I mean, being from out of state and then coming here, I'm like, I get the eyebrows. I was like, hey, you know?
Very interesting. Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So, what do you think? I know that we're losing some of this basic human interaction and we're losing a lot of the things we can gain together because we're kind of just innately pitting one another against each other for sport now, it seems like. And I think that one of the big reasons is we don't communicate so well anymore. And I know that you've got a horse in that race. Can you talk to me a little bit about our tact communicating, not only verbally, but in the written word and how that's lost? Because I think some of the thinking before we talk thing that our parents always told us about, we just don't do anymore. And part of it, we kind of got out of habit of it because a lot of us don't write anymore unless it's these immediate things,
right.
Text and whatever. It's not like a piece of communication where we can edit it a tiny bit and we don't really write letters anymore. So talk to me a little bit about your feelings and experience with the way our communication is kind of going or has gone.
Yeah. And we don't read anymore. Like that's, you know.
We joke that
nobody even reads
an
email, but nobody even reads. I mean, the reading is, you know, it's a smaller percentage of people reading, you know, the
articles
that we've got, articles. Or we claim we're reading when we read the headline, and now we think we know everything. And if I'm really, really into it, I'm going to read the sub-headline, and now I'm really,
I'm ready
know
for the debate
on.
Stage.
Exactly. So, no, and not only with writing that, I mean, yes, writing is, it's I don't know. I taught freshmen in college, and I have a son who it's painful for him to write. And we definitely have lost any that. And now we have the help of AI to – and I'm not totally opposed to that in certain circumstances. I may think it's there. But if you struggle to write, you don't even have to anymore, right? Like
right.
To write that tough email, to write an agenda, you know, copy for something. So
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, our entire way of communicating has totally – changed. And now I'm not one to think also that change has to be bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there's probably a lot of good things in this, and we're just in the growing pains of it, figuring out where those are and what we can accept and what we can work with. But yeah, as a communication form, I did a whole TED talk on the importance of letter writing and how it is a lost art, a lost habit, a lost, you know, ritual, and the value in doing that, in hand, pen to paper, in the fact that in writing a letter, you are thinking about that person. You're spending a little bit of time with that person because you have to be not on a phone, not doing this, not doing that. You're focused on writing that letter. And then you're taking the time. I mean, it is literal evidence that somebody not only thought about you, but that they took the time to then find the paper, to put it, write it down, put it in an envelope, find your address, find a stamp, you know, a lot of people don't have this at their fingertips. In fact, in these college classes that I taught, I would do letter writing every time. I just bought bunches of cards and I would have them write letters. And every time I had to draw the envelope and teach them how to address an envelope. Like that's a lost art. That's a lost skill. People don't know how to address an envelope. They don't know how to put a stamp on it. They don't know what side it goes on. So
my kids weren't even taught it in school.
Yeah.
I had to teach them how.
Yeah. And now, so now does it mean that we should only be communicating with letters? Of course not, right? I mean, things expand and grow. I mean, I had a pen pal that I met in seventh grade, spent a dollar in my French class, and I got her address, and she and I wrote to each other. So that built a beautiful, beautiful sisterhood. I mean, we were super close. And
that's
I would
so cool.
write to her in French, and she'd write to me in English. And then I went and spent the summer with her, the summer after my freshman year in college. And then the next summer she spent with me. And then years later, I was the only witness in her wedding. Like, I was her maid of honor in France.
Cool.
And then since then, you know, she's visited here. We've taken my parents, my kids, everybody to visit her family. And it all started from writing letters. But as life changed, we also really don't write letters anymore. We correspond all the time. We did a fun little pretend be real thing where we were sending a picture of ourselves every day to each other. That went on for a while. So we find other ways to stay connected. And I think there is value in that. I mean, even from a Wordle, for example, like that's a form of communication if you're sharing it. Like there's several people I always share my Wordle with every day. And even if we don't say anything else with it, oh, I've just thought of Kim. I've just thought of Raquel. I've just thought of my mom because I've sent that. So you have that moment of touching each other. So I think there's other ways that we need to be intentional about how we communicate and what we're doing. I know younger generation hates picking up the phone. Like they can't make a phone call. So I mean, even
That's
a different way to do that. But will they do maybe a video? Okay, we'll take that. That's maybe a step up. It's better. You can really see someone's space. You can get the tour of their new apartment. You can connect in a way that we couldn't before with just letters or then with just phones. So I think it's all an adjustment. And I think it comes back again around to like the value of connecting with other people, the desire to connect with other people, and then being that authentic, allowing yourselves to be a little vulnerable to do that, and then you find the way to do it. And that's going to be multiple ways, right?
Right. Yeah. So the writing conveys a genuine sentiment and the fact of the time investment, which speaks to every human because we all know time is our non-renewable resource.
Yeah.
So here's the million-dollar question for the seventh graders out there right now who are getting a pen pal that's an email. If you can remind your time, do you think that you would tell the same story had you just written emails to this person in France?
So I had a kind of a two-part thought to that. One, I would say if you're disciplined and if you're committed to it, both parties. Right. If both parties are super committed to it and you continue to write and that when you get an email, you respond to that email and you continue going.
Mm-hmm.
But my guess is that more likely than not, it doesn't necessarily continue. So my friend Benet, who's in Bordeaux, when our kids got together, we brought them all over and my son was 10-ish years ago. So he was 12-ish. Okay. And her son was 12-ish. And they immediately went upstairs and they were quiet and gone. We're like, where'd the boys go? And we're like, ah, they're probably playing video games, right?
Right.
Well, they had actually found a way and they were doing Google Translate and talking to each other. And it
oh,
was
dang.
Awesome and fantastic. And we went out to dinner that night and they are cracking each other up and laughing and the best of buddies. Okay, they're great. And even still, years later, they saw each other again. Hilarious, cracking up, having a great time.
Very cool.
However, in anything in between there, nope. They tried to be, you know, Snapchat buddies or whatever, be friends on chat. My daughter did it with one of Benet's nieces. And it went no further than like a couple snaps to start with. Like they didn't really get to know each other. They never really took it anywhere deeper. So I don't know, right? Like I don't
know. Because that time investment doesn't have to be
made. I don't know that I would be saying that. And pre-internet, what were we doing? We were sending maps of our hometowns and circling where we were. We were sending pictures of our family and then taking the time to label them. This is my mom. This is my dad. This is my son. So we had a whole other, like we would share books eventually. We'd send, oh, here's a book. And I'd say, can you send me a simple book that's written in French? And it's a pre-Amazon. I couldn't just buy one.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So I mean, because of that, it did forge much deeper connections, so much so that I moved to live a month with her family without ever having met her in real life until I stepped off the plane in Paris.
That's crazy.
So, I mean, right? Like, I mean, it was a super special connection that came from letter writing and that investment in getting to know one another.
Yeah, those are such unique experiences. I really hope they don't go extinct. Yeah,
me too.
So your writing has brought you a lot of things in life and you've been able to share it a little bit. Talk to me about your writing, your novels. Talk to me about your books and what you were hoping to share with them.
Yeah, sure. Well, so I always knew I wanted to write a book. And then I was blogging for a while I was a doula.
When was this?
Mother's Circle. So it was like 2007, 8, 9, and
So early blog days.
10-ish years, early blog days. Not quite as early as I should have been, but yeah. My husband kept saying, you should do this. I'm like, I don't know what to write about. And then I was at a dinner party one night, and they took out the computer, and after a couple glasses of wine, here I am signing up for a WordPress account. And I was like, all right, now I got to write something.
There you go.
So I did, and I loved it. It was like that toe back into like, oh my gosh, like with little kids, I'd been writing journals for them. I'd been doing very different kind of writing. My career was press releases and competitive market reports. It was a totally different kind of writing. So this blogging, I was like, huh. I like got my toe back into some creativity.
Nice.
At first I thought, I'm just going to do this to say, you know, the moms that everybody calls me about X, Y, and Z. I'm going to do a blog post about that. Then I'll be able to answer them with some personalized information and say, go read the blog post. That never ended up happening. That was the vision, and then never ended up. I ended up writing about like boys and bruises was one of my favorite posts about my son, how he like threw himself on everything and constantly had some scar, scrape, scratch, bloody spot, and would literally fall and be like, I'm okay, no matter what, all the time. So right, good, fine. So like, but I just got into like the like gritty stuff of family life and it being a mom, and I loved it. And I would only have to write 500-800 words, and it was great. And it was a great way to just start honing again and getting back into some creativity, even though it was creative nonfiction.
Right.
And then I read this Kindle book, like it was a free Kindle, and it said how to write a book in a weekend. And I was like, well, let me see. How do you do that? So I read the book, and I was like, all right, challenge on. Now, this is not possible with fiction, although I'll get to a fast-paced thing that I'm in the middle of right now with fiction. But so I was like, all right, let me do this. I took an outline for this book called Naked Parenting, and I brought like Trader Joe's frozen food and a bag of salad and a box of tea, and I went to my parents' house. They were away, and I went away for the weekend.
There you go.
I was like, well, I'm going to write a book in a weekend. So sure enough, I started Friday morning. It was 3 days. It was cheating. But Friday morning, I started, and by Saturday lunchtime, I had my entire first draft, about 26,000 words.
Dang.
Now, with – again, nonfiction, totally different, but manageable, I felt like. But still, yeah, dang, I was excited.
Yeah.
So then by the time I left on Sunday afternoon, I had done my first revision and first read-through. I wrote a book in a weekend. So yeah. It was great. But so I had these two books, and my vision, I had all these great ideas of offshoots of this and taking these seven keys to parenting that help parents be confident. It was me empowering parents so that – because you can't tackle every problem ever. So I'm like, if I can empower you to be a parent in confidently, then you can tackle any old thing at any old age – by using these kind of seven keys and these skills. So, you know, gratitude and honesty and discipline and communication was one of them. So make mistakes. So taking those key skills and then applying them to any problem in your life. So I had this great idea, though. Can you apply these skills to volunteerism, to sleep, to eating, to I don't know. I had all sorts of fun ideas. And I only did one other one. It was the one my blog readers voted on, and it was like, cyberspace and all that stuff. And it was kind of not my favorite topic, but I did it, and I did a ton of research for it. And I tried to make it evergreen. So like you're thinking of it not to do with whatever the app of the day is or the platform of the day is.
Right.
So yeah, so I did those, and then it just kind of got me started on that. But my novel, I must have been hitting 40, and I was like, listen, if I look back in my life, this is what I'm going to regret, is not writing a novel. Like, this is what I need to do. And so I just started really trying to prioritize that. And it took me a long time, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I mean, I just was coming at it from a million angles. And when you're like that, I was a pantser. I've turned to be a plotter. But I just didn't know what I was doing. I was just writing it, and then I had to keep going back and back and back. And I learned to write, studied the craft. I had editors and beta readers, and I just kept
refining. Yeah, how did you teach yourself to do that?
I read a lot and then practice a lot. And also, it's like reading the craft, right? So literally learning different things about craft, or I'm struggling with, okay, well, I don't know what, a point of view, or how to get closer in a point of view, how to get emotion on the page. Mm-hmm. Okay, go study that. But also, it's literally just reading. So I read for pleasure, but I also read with the mindset of a writer. So a lot of times, you know, I'm reading and saying, well, wait a second, I just felt a lot of emotion. How did she do that?
Reverse engineering kind of
reading. Exactly. And that's really an important part of being a writer. So I think I'm using a lot of those skills to come back around to how to get I forgot what the question was. Sorry.
No, you're good. So how does getting your toe back in the water of creative writing with this blog eventually get you to now you're starting, this book in a weekend. How do we make it to the novel?
Okay, thank you. So, so I'm like, this is what I'm going to regret if I don't do it. And I start diving in. So I get to a point where I really think that this is going to be it. Like I said, multiple editors, paid editors, beta readers, all that stuff. And then submitted to some small presses, got picked up by one small little press that was a great way to start my career. It was perfect to get me out there. It won 9 awards. It was really an exciting time. I absolutely loved it and was like, yep, bring me more.
What was the title of that book? How did that go?
Yeah, that's called Forks, Knives, and Spoons. And it was based on this silly thing that my dad did in real life. And so he had taken with my mom, but we'd gone out to dinner right before I went to college. I was the oldest. Mm-hmm. And he may have had some reason to believe that I was a little naive, and he would be like, we balance protecting you and like teaching you, but I think we may have erred a little too much on protecting you. Like, oh my gosh, you're sending her to college. So his last like lesson was like, okay, there's three kinds of guys. There's forks, knives, and spoons. And so he kind of explained like the forks are sort of arrogant and cocky and the players, and they're the ones that are going to, you know, sleep and ditch you kind of thing. So he had this kind of vision. And then he's like, and then the spoons are sort of now, remember, this is late 80s, so they're the losers. They're the dorks, not the dorks of the current age where are cool.
Like, where dorks took
they
over.
Were like the geeks of the 80s, right? Yeah, so different kind of a geek. And he was like, yeah, but the best guy you're going to find in the knife category, and it's a big category, and there's all sorts of knives in here, but you're going to find somebody who's like maybe not as cocky or confident as the knife, as the fork. But so he just gives me this little run through, and I'm like, yeah, okay, what? So I go to college and share it with my floor mates and my friends. And it was viral before viral was a thing, right? Like, we just started using this in language. We're like, oh my God, that guy was such a fork. And it just became the way we spoke.
Right.
And I had friends who made little earrings out into forks. And then it grew, right? Like, it was like, then there were pitchforks and sporks and butcher knives and you know, like salad forks and
every subgenre,
right? It got crazy. So my dad loved that. But he was like, well, when are you going to write this book? And I was like, it's not a story. That is an anecdote. That is a little fun thing. It is not a story. Mm-hmm. So I had to kind of back into a story. And so it takes place in the 80s, a coming of age story. And Amy York's father, who is very much like my own father, Amy York's father tells her this thing about three kinds of guys. And she buys into it really deeply. And she and her really skeptical roommate at college, they test it out, like through heartbreaks and romances. And along the way, they kind of swap, and she starts to be like, this is stupid, and her best friend is like, ooh, this really works. But really, along the way, what they really learn as they're on this quest for their perfect steak knife, which is like the perfect guy, like little edgy, little sharp, but, you know. So on this quest, though, they learn to believe in themselves and not tie their value to a guy. So, like, that's the ultimate message is, you know, be you, don't tie your value to a man, and don't have that be your... You know, it was time specific, late 80s, early 90s. That was still, you know, I mean, we were going off for careers, but it was also, you know, you're also looking for a guy. So,
yeah, right.
So anyway, so that's where that sort of stemmed from. So I created the story into that and then started my next book. Once that promotional period was over, started working on it. And that's like 5 long years ago. I'm trying to sell that one. I'm trying to, I'm pitching that to agents. And it's a tough business, particularly right now. We are in a time of contraction and some very interesting, you know, shifts as in many other industries. So I've kind of tabled that. I'm still out there with a lot of agents. I still have a lot of full manuscripts out there for consideration by several small presses. And in the meantime, I am putting my head back down because I've spent too much of this year not really writing in a project, kind of. And so now I've really zeroed in on what I want to work on. And I'm participating in, that's where this fast-paced thing of November is. I don't know if you've heard of NaNoWriMo.
I have not.
So National Novel Writers Month. So it was, many years ago, maybe decades now. And so it's kind of this challenge for people to write a novel in a month. It's 50,000 words, which is not really a novel. It's a novella, or it's maybe middle grade or YA.
Seems like a lot of words.
It is, but well, yeah. I'm always trying to scale back. So, in my genre, it would be like 80 to, and I write book club fiction. I'd say like 80 to 90,000 is sort of where the mark is right now. But I've always, I love a challenge. This is something that people are doing not nationwide, internationally right now, like across the world. And there's websites and blog things. There's swag and things to buy and books about it. It's like a big, big, big thing.
Right.
But I've never had a project that lined up. I was always, you know, I'm not going to give up a month of revising, or I'm not going to give a month of something else. I wasn't ready to start a new project. So
This
year, it lined up perfectly. So I spent October prepping and like really knowing what I was going for, like looking for, you know, deciding on the outlines and the character points and the plot points, all of those things. And so then I've been writing. So I'm so far behind. I'm about 5,000 words behind where I should be, but I'm still plugging away. I've written every single day of the month.
Awesome.
And I'm working at it. And if I have a couple really good days, as long as I don't get too much further behind, I will catch up. Like, it's my goal. Oh my gosh, now I'm saying this publicly. Like, yeah. I haven't really told many people, but now I'm saying it publicly. I'm going to write 50,000 words for this month. So at least I'll have the big chunk of a first draft of that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it makes me feel so happy being back into it.
So remind me just a little bit to when you start writing the novel and you know you've got this anecdote that you could bring into a story. What's the jump off for this? What makes you decide, yes, I'm going to do this and bite off this bit to chew when you've got other things going on?
You mean the last book, the first book?
Yeah, the first book, yeah.
Well, just because I literally knew I was being untrue and would be betraying my own dreams, like myself, if I didn't do it.
Gotcha.
So that was really like the kick in the butt.
So did that keep the crisis of faith as you were writing it down? It was just, I got to do this no matter what?
Yeah. I mean, writing's hard. Writing is really hard. Like, and the first draft is always like, I think it was, Anne Lamott, maybe shitty first drafts. Like, it's never good. And if anybody tells you it's good, they're absolutely wrong or absolutely lying, or they're your mother.
Yeah. Right.
So
a first draft only a mother
can
love.
It's just like, get it out. And then you have something to edit. You have something to work with. You have something to start sculpting and molding and layering. It's like, it's almost like the first draft is, you know, if you take a big block of, you know, wood or marble, right? And it's just this sort of getting the shape of it. And then from there, you're going to tweak, and eventually you'll see the fingernails or the wrinkle in the skin. You know, you get down to that granular level. But I forgot the question.
No, I feel like a lot of people would see the writing process as the inverse of that, where you would start with the minutiae and try to build out the whole thing.
Yeah, no, and actually that was part of what I learned a lot writing that novel, and I think a lot of it I learned a lot of how to write a novel and approach it. And I certainly have since then. I've gotten a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing. I go to conferences all the time. I'm constantly reading. But it's really the opposite. So if you can take the big structural things and know, I mean, every story, there's structure there. So every story, every movie, every commercial, every song, if it's done well and if it really hits the human nerve, like, it is because there's an underlying structure. But there's a gazillion ways to creatively do that. And if it's done well, you don't even see the structure. We know and we anticipate, and there's a million creative ways to play with that. But what I did with my first book is I wrote myself some gorgeous scenes, and I wrote myself into these, like, down to the line level of working on the prose and the word choice and all that. And then that scene was cut because it didn't work. So you're like, that novel was, I think, in the 90,000 word range. Might have been a little bit longer. It was long. But I have a discarded file, and it was about 100,000 words. So like, I pulled out more than I even, and even still in the last book, even though I did that, as you work, you trim back like a rose bush, and you kind of get in there and pull it back. But yeah, if you can kind of know what your scenes are, then you can sit and I think of it as two sides of the brain. So like, one side is sort of this figuring out the thinking part, if you will, like, what's going to happen and why is that going to happen and what is her motivation and, you know, what's the value shift going to be in this scene and where is she going to begin, where is she going to end, all that stuff. So then if I can plot that, then when I sit to write, I'm just like, okay, and then the creative juices are flowing. I can just write because I know sort of what needs to happen or what needs to be, and then I don't, maybe the location changes, maybe somebody shows up that's new and interesting and different that you didn't expect, and that's where all the creativity can kind of flow from there. But then the last thing is really polishing the prose, because why do you want to do that when really that whole scene or that thing may not work and may go away anyway?
Is that the common way things are written, or is that just the way that you found works well for you?
Well, Everybody does their own thing. I mean, honestly, that's what one of the things that took me a long time to figure out. I thought there was one way. I thought there was a magic way. I thought that I would go to events, author events all the time and sit in the front row. And my first question was like, can you tell me about your process? You know, like thinking that they're going to tell me how to do this thing of writing a novel, how. And there are people who will presume to tell you how they do it and how that they're doing it the right way. But what I learned is like, huh. They got a novel written doing it this way. They got a novel written doing it this way, this way, this way, this way, this way. So, yes, can you get wisdom from ways people do stuff? Sure. But you're going to pull like a toolbox into making your own style. And there's plenty of people who don't do any sort of plotting. Like, they pants it. They may know the very beginning and how they want it to end, and they have this vague general idea of an arc. They will probably have a lot more hours. This is what I learned. It took me a lot more hours and work to get back into something that is the feel of a structure and feel of the beats are gotcha. Falling where they should. But yeah, I think that as many writers as there are, you're going to find as many ways to do it. And I think also too, every single book that each person writes, I could probably say that they're refining it, they're changing how they write it, and they're growing as a writer. So, you know, people always say they look back and they're like, oh, cringe a little bit at those early books, or you'd edit it. Like, you can't, there's some point you have to say good enough and move forward because like you could keep going back to published books and be like, oh, I overwrote there, or, oh, I would change that here.
Yeah, and that was something I wanted to ask you. You mentioned you've got a plot of discarded material that's almost as big as what became the book.
Yeah.
How is that decision process? Because I can't imagine that everything that ends up in the discarded pile is something you didn't like.
No, it's called Kill Your Darlings. A lot of times it's stuff you do like, and you have to fight yourself to say, no, it doesn't belong here. Take it out.
Yeah, what's that process
really
like?
I mean, that is the process of revision. And it's, this is partly why I took on this NaNoWriMo I don't love my first draft process. Like, I don't love, for me, the first draft, it's so out there, which is fun because I get to create in the thinking of that. But it's also like you're just staring at a blank page. The second I get to revise, oh, now it's fun. And now I go deeper and deeper. And I can I have something that's there that whole pieces might come out, redundant pieces or things that just don't work with the storyline anymore. You know, the lie that she believes may have – I was like, oh, no, that's not the lie anymore. It's going to be this one. Now I have to revise that. No, and it's really hard because it is pulling a thread. So if you change something, you know, any of those things, you got to change that all the way through. For continuity.
Yeah, it's
for
not
all
Back
that.
To the Future. Not an alternate 1985.
It's like you really have to make sure all those threads. I'm actually really good at that. I think I missed my calling as a continuity, like either for film or for books. I'll be like, oh, nope, wrong. That happened wrong. Like, or they, you know, nope, she did this backwards. Or, oh, I'm always finding the continuity errors when I'm reading.
Once one of those that you've caught good in a movie, I know those happen in books and movies all the time.
Yeah. The first thing I can think of is, I think it was, Helen Hunt and Jack Nicholson. Rainy scene. I can't remember. It's so long ago. Good. I feel like good is in the title. But I don't know. But there's one scene. She's outside his door, and she's soaking wet from the rain, and you can see her bra strap. And then they cut away, and then the next scene, soaking wet, no bra. Yeah. So little details like that. But like, I love finding that stuff. But I'm like, ha-ha.
But that's the kind of thing that – in totality makes your book or your piece more engaging because there aren't those little inconsistencies.
Yeah. Well, anything that's going to take a reader out of the story, anything, whether they be like, nope, not credible, anything that pulls them out, oh, that's the author's voice. I'm out of the story now. You don't want that. That's an opportunity for them to put the book down and stop reading anymore. So you want them to be fully immersed and not be giving them any reason to pull out. We can go along with any character as long as we understand why they did it, right? Like, we can say, I would never do that, or that's the dumbest thing ever. But if we understand, well, yeah, but because she had this history or she had this motivation, we understand why she would have made that choice. So now we can go along with it. But if something is so absurd or it's so like, no, this character, there's no way, or this is not credible, now you're out of the story again. So
it's that keeping a world where you can suspend disbelief.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I always say I don't like sci-fi, but then if I read it, if a story is a story is a story, like if it's a good story and it's a well-written story and it's got characters and growth, I mean, okay, so all of a sudden it doesn't matter that they're vampires. Like, you've just suspended that and I'm right there with you.
The backbone of a good love story.
Yeah,
songs are
right.
A lot like that too.
That's right.
You know, love songs sometimes sound very different.
Yeah, so true.
So you can use your creative mind quite well to do these things, and I know you can use your creative mind for some more analytical things. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the philanthropic things and some of the stuff you did setting up the medical center or helping set up the medical center in Uganda. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, so I
would... How does that come to be in an author world?
They're a little bit separate, but it does intersect with the event planning world. So we had we were in Rhode Island. Church we went to there had these kids come in from Uganda, and it was a choir. And these kids came in, choir, dancing, singing. And one of my friends was hosting some of these kids, and I was like, I saw this lovely connection that she had with them, and I was like, well, I want that. I want to know them. I want them to know me. I want us to understand. So I said, next time they come, like we're hosting. Like, make sure I know I want to be able to host.
Very cool.
So they did, came back around a couple years later, and we hosted four girls, 12, 13, they were exact ages of my two older kids, and then a, like 40-ish somewhere in there chaperone who stayed with us. And, you know, we spent, it was just awesome. Like, literally from the moment that they pulled in, it was late Sunday night, they were so tired. They moved different locations every single week, and they're two dancing. And so it's super late. We greet them outside. It's dark. We welcome them in. And there was something that night I said to my husband, I was like, wow, like, I just feel like we're going to be and they're going to be in our lives and us in their lives somehow, some way. I don't know how, but I feel like we're always going to be in each other's lives. And so we had an amazing week with them, getting to know them, laughing with them, you know, talking with Dorothy, the chaperone, who, like, we were a similar age and like how divergent our lives had been, and her running from, you know, war and being dragged by, you know, her mother because she refused to go, and the mother knew there was danger, and she dragged her. She goes like a goat and pulled her away. So, I mean, and I was like, what? And what was I doing? I was like, you know, having a beer in college or something.
It's times like that you realize the world's a big place.
Yeah, exactly. And again, that connection of learning about other, and I knew that even this small, like, the stories she told me that were so powerful were like a sliver of like her experiences. But so during this time that they were there, we went to several of the concerts, and we learned that it took like, I think it was like $2,000 to send a kid to college. And then it was like, we need, you know, this, they had several needs that they talked about. Mm-hmm. And I said, maybe it was six, I can't remember, but I said, to my husband, I said, all right, what if we like just have a party at our house and we'll say this is a goal is to raise $6,000 to send one kid to college. And then maybe next year we can send two kids to college. I said, among our friends, we can do this. We can get $6,000 if they know that there's this purpose and a, you know, a specific need. And so my friend calls me. She's like, so I just heard that you were talking about doing, you know, trying to fund scholarships for kids. And I was like, yeah. She's like, well, you know, they really need a medical center. I was like, all right, we could raise the money for that instead. And she goes, yes, that's $70,000. I was like, oh, okay. Well, that's no longer a little party in my backyard. We gotta rethink this. But yeah, so we said, all right, fine, let's do it. And people were telling me, no, don't do it all at once. Try to get a little this year, a little next year. I was like, absolutely not. We are doing this. We're gonna get this money. And we're like, even still, I was like, $70,000. If we're gonna get that, that can change a million, you know, so many people's lives. It could change a whole community. How are we? Of course, we're gonna do this. So, in 6 months' time, I had a group together. We had logo. We had a website. I had all these volunteers. We had a gala event, and we had part of the funding done already, a good chunk of it before the gala. And by the end of the gala, we were over our goal, $82,000.
Yes.
So, so it was great.
And this was your first endeavor of anything like this?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Yeah, that scale for sure. Yeah, and so we did the big event of that was where the event planning came back in because now I wasn't working. I was, you know, home with kids and had done little like sort of more project based or small consulting kind of things. But yeah, so we did that and it was amazing. And then there was a counterpart in the UK, and they raised money for the medical equipment. So that has since been there, like that's there. And we're in this final push of there's a few things that they're still, I mean, this has been years in the making, but there's a lot of, they dug those foundations by hand, like shovels, like I'd get the pictures along the way.
Good
shovels
Lord.
By hand, and then the permits, and then COVID had slowed it down. They were ready to open, and then COVID slowed. But in any case, we're really on the cusp. Like, they've got a lot of the medical equipment down there. It's been functioning for the kids who live there. Mm-hmm. It hasn't opened yet to the community, is my understanding. I'm due for an update. But in any case, I got to go down there. The founder of this Kampala Children's Center is what it's called. Mm-hmm. And then this is called the Destiny or Medical – they changed the name on it. So Hope and Wellness, the Medical Center for Hope and Wellness. Mm-hmm. And but we got to walk through it before it was finished. So I went down with my oldest daughter and my parents, and we walked through the site and got to – like physically walk on the ground.
What was that feeling like?
It was amazing. And it was amazing to be able to do that with my parents, who had also contributed so much, and to be able to see the kids that we had, you know, housed and we had multiple years after that, and then to be able to meet new kids and to see – we taught classes for them. My dad taught a great electrical – he was an electrical engineer, and he taught a great class for them.
That's so cool.
It just was like just an incredible experience. But yeah, like, I mean, really brought me to tears to walk through something that's so tangible, that was so abstract, really, you know, and that to know that it was going to really make such a difference. Just driving from the airport to the center, driving in that community. I mean, I don't know if you've, you know, how much you've traveled or third world countries, and I've done a lot of traveling, but that was, I mean, it's like heavy on your heart to see the great, great, great poverty. And then also, though, to see the great optimism that a lot of them, you know, especially these kids, who the kids are there because they're orphaned. And they're raised in family setting at this children's center. That's how they're raised, yeah.
What do you think allows the juxtaposition of this horribly desperate life in some regards and optimism to coexist?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I know that answer, but, you know, they are very faith-based. There's a lot of that. At least this school was, so I don't know how much I can extrapolate that out to a broader community. And then I also would probably argue it's probably because when you don't know differently necessarily, I mean, they're struggling, but maybe there's the kid. The founder used to say that when the kids came over here, they had a little bit of sometimes struggle with those kids when they got back, because they were staying in all these you know, American homes with plenty. More than plenty, right? All of us having such selections in our refrigerator and the grocery stores, all of that.
Talk about culture shock.
It was. And so he sometimes had a problem going back, or that those kids then kind of would call, you know, their people in the United States sort of trying to – but at the same time, it also served to – as a motivation, where they would say, oh, I didn't know this was possible for me, or – you know, I wanted to be a doctor, and then, you know, we would show them, like, I would have classes sometimes when the kids came over and have them get to experience, like, a doctor, can I get you to shadow, these kids to shadow you? So I would arrange things like that for them, little experiences. So I think there is also, to me, travel, anything that opens your eyes, opens your worldview, opens your experiences, is going to, you know, hopefully have some benefits, plant seeds of something that you can then strive for. So, you know, I think that he would explain that there's sort of a double-edged sword to that going overseas.
Right.
It became a little less manageable for him, but then also I think that maybe that plants some really great seeds. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know. There was like a beautiful faith that I saw, that maybe that's where some of that optimism comes from, a hope for better. And maybe, too, it's about relationships, you know? Maybe
yeah, right.
It comes back down to where we started here.
It's, yep, that's kind of
it's connections and family and, you know, being there for one another and singing together and sharing meals and, you know.
Yeah, it's weird how that kind of works. You know, you got to see what was possible for you and going from maybe a dinner party to a full-on gala and doing this, and they get to see what's possible for them. You know, you can hang out in your life and be good with what you have, but as soon as you find out how far the ladder goes and someone's going to empower you, you can start climbing that ladder.
Absolutely. That's a great way to put it.
So what do you think's next on the ladder for you? What do you want to see next for you? Another book?
Yeah, for sure. So it's a tough business, and it would be really easy to walk away from. And there's days I want to, but just because it's a tough business, if you want to publish, right? If you want to just write for yourself, then you
well, there's got to be about as many authors now as there is songwriters. I mean, now self-publishing is quite a bit easier now than what it used to be, correct?
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. Indie publishing. And I think that too, you know, I don't have a huge ego about a lot of this. So especially at my age, I feel like I'm, you know, have my own confidence. But what I do see is that like I indie published Naked Parenting because I was doing it as a publishing experiment too. I was like, all right, well, heck, I've got these. My husband's a designer and we can do this and let's see what happens.
There you go.
But I also knew my buying habits tended to be much more that nonfiction. No matter what I buy, no matter how it's published, I'm going to learn something from it. And the same way now, though, there's a lot of my friends, and there's such low barriers to entry, but there's a lot of beautifully independently published books that are having trouble finding home elsewhere. And so I think that if it's a good story, the readers don't care how it gets to them.
Right.
But it is a little bit harder to get to the readers without a platform. It's a little harder to get to the readers just indie publishing without any sort of you know, support with, you know, getting into bookstores. That's a whole, like, another several podcasts to get
into right,
all
yeah,
that.
Right.
But yeah, it's publishing is a tough business. And even when you're traditionally published, a lot, not a lot, most of the promotion anyway falls to the author. So it's, yeah, it's...
It's a tangled web that got
really,
even more
really,
tangled.
It really quite is, yeah.
All right, well, tangled webs can be no fun. So let's get you out of here on something fun.
Okay.
If you could write a letter and get a response from any person, dead or alive, who would you write the letter to?
I think right now I'm going to pick my dad.
Yeah?
So, yeah, I lost him a year and a half ago.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, he, you know, I'm one of those weird novelists who had a great childhood, like they always say.
Yeah, right.
Like, I have nothing to just pull from on that. I had a very idyllic childhood.
You mean you didn't live in a train car?
I know, right? So, yeah, I feel very grateful for that. And so... I had a great relationship with my dad, and he was diagnosed with ALS in the February of 2021. And we grieved a lot then and through that year while he was with us because it was terminal, right? You know where this is going.
Yeah.
But we were already very close, but he also was – he was always a great leader in life, but through this, he was really a great leader in his death as well. And he just encouraged us, and I asked him everything. Like, I was just like – and even, like, my family was like, how do you know this? How – I said, I'm just asking. Like, I'm asking him questions. And he encouraged us to do that. So we had literally had nothing left unsaid. There are still things, though, that I'm like, oh, shoot, I wish I had asked that one, or what about this one, or – you know. But we just, at the end, like, shared stories. We recorded him telling stories and – you know, going back on funny things that he did and things that we wanted on tape. How old I am on tape. But anyway, so yeah, I think that I would just, you know, I think he died knowing that we were coming here to be with my mom. He died knowing that he was greatly loved and that, you know, like I said, nothing left unsaid, but still, I think it's that longing and to still hear from him, you know?
Yeah, very cool. Yeah. So you're at least second generation empowerer then.
Yeah, yeah, he absolutely was. I got a lot of that from him. He was a great mentor to many, and yeah.
So cool.
Truly.
Well, Leah, I had a great time hearing from you. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming down, and I hope we get to do this again sometime. We'll talk about the next book and everything down the road.
All right.
Thank
I love
you,
it.
Leah.
Thank you. This is great.
Yeah,
have a lot
awesome.
Of fun.
Thank you.
Thanks.